Pass.
Contracts, workplace rights, trademarks, even your digital identity online. Law is an everyday part of life, and having knowledge about these topics can help you become a more informed citizen. That's why Queen's is offering the Certificate in Law, an online program designed to provide a foundational understanding of Canadian law through a series of fascinating courses. Discover if law is right for you. To find out more, visit takelaw.ca. You can hear Pro Bono Radio on most podcasting platforms and broadcasting weekly on CFRC 101.9 FM, Kingston's only campus and community radio station. If you're interested in learning more about Pro Bono Radio, check out probonoradio.com. The Queen's Faculty of Law has been a leader in Canadian legal education since 1957. If you're interested in learning more about getting a legal education, visit law.queensu.ca.
This podcast does not contain legal advice. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law student volunteers and are not lawyers that are authorized to provide legal advice. The podcast contains general discussion of certain legal and related issues only. If you require legal advice, please consult with a lawyer. Good morning and welcome to Pro Bono Radio at Queen's Law. We're your hosts, Kevin and Chris. Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting legal topics that aims to make legal discussions more accessible to you. We strive to stimulate interest and provide information while always being entertaining. This episode explores the ethics and legality around shoplifting civil recovery letters.
Given the subject matter of today's show, I'd be remiss not to recognize the traditional Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee lands upon which this show is produced. In the hopes that land seized was a lapse in judgment, a mistake that forever altered history, and that it can be forgiven, trust can be re-earned, and a bridge rebuilt between our two cultures. The hope that here, in acknowledgement of true ownership, we forsake the past, not to do away with it, but to own our own mistakes and embrace a future that can be better.
We're excited to have Amy Salazin, who is an associate professor at the University of Ottawa Faculty of Law, to share insights on this topic. Amy received her JD from the University of Toronto and LLM from Yale Law School. After law school, Amy served as a judicial law clerk at the Court of Appeal for Ontario and practiced at a Toronto litigation boutique that included a wide variety of civil and commercial litigation matters. Amy has published 2 chapters in books and over 10 articles in international peer-reviewed journals. We are interviewing Amy because she is an expert in this area of law and has written about it. So Amy, to start off our question, we were wondering if you could explain what a shoplifting civil recovery letter is.
Sure, and thanks so much for having me on your podcast. So at the most general level, a shoplifting civil recovery letter is a type of demand letter. And as many of your listeners may know, demand letters are regularly sent by lawyers. Essentially, a lawyer writes a letter to someone or a corporation asking that either they maybe take a certain course of action or refrain from doing something they're doing. So you could have a lawyer, for example, working for a tenant as a client who sends a demand letter to their landlord saying, you know, you need to do these repairs that the law requires you to do. So very common type thing. So shoplifting civil recovery letters are kind of a subset or a particular type of demand letter. And the context in which they arise is that they are demand letters sent by lawyers acting for retailers to suspected shoplifters or their parents. And so these letters are sent to individuals after they've been apprehended at a retail location and accused of shoplifting. And at that point in time, the retailer gets their name and information, passes that on to a lawyer, and a letter is sent. And these letters, the ones I've looked at, dozens and dozens, the ones I've looked at contain three common features. So a demand for payment, and the ones I've looked at kind of range from $300 to $600, much more than the value and not tied to the value of the goods suspected of being taken. Oftentimes the letter cites kind of aggregated security costs and trying to defray those costs. The letter also contains a claim that a viable cause of action exists against the recipient. Sometimes these are sent to parents, so they say there's a claim against the parent, or sometimes they're sent to the suspected shoplifter themselves. And then an indication that if this payment is not made, then the retailer may commence a civil action, so may commence an action in court. And these are fairly common in both Canada and the United States. When I studied these a few years ago, I just asked one Toronto legal clinic to track how many of these were, how many calls about these letters they were getting. And within 6 months, they got 50 calls from recipients of these letters, something we've seen in various media stories as well. So it's certainly a fairly common practice, and a number of Canadian retailers are hiring lawyers to send these letters.
So Professor Salazin, you've mentioned that it's a very common practice, but it sounds almost unethical. And as readers or viewers might actually read in your paper, hopefully, you mentioned that it's an unethical practice. Could you explain why sending SCRLs is considered unethical by so many lawyers?
Yeah, and thank you for that. We can use the abbreviation SCRL, because it's a bit shorter than saying the whole term. And yeah, there are a fair amount of these letters going out. From what I could tell, I should mention it's a fairly small number of lawyers who are sending out many, many letters. They're essentially form letters, so they're very easy to pump out at high volume. And so the media, public legal organizations, and academics have noticed these letters and raised some concerns about lawyers being involved. And essentially what it boils down to is concerns that these letters contain misrepresentations. I noted that these letters contain an assertion that a legal claim exists, and the viability of these legal claims are very much in question. It doesn't really seem that there's a plausible legal claim in these letters. I can go into more detail later on that. And this idea that they're going to commence a civil action if you don't pay, when in fact we don't actually see any retailers going after people in court to claim money if these people don't pay up. And so what's argued is if you really have a letter that contains claims don't have a plausible legal basis, the client doesn't have any intent to sue, the concern is that the point in writing the letter is really to trick people into paying this money. The people that receive these letters generally aren't lawyers, generally don't know how to assess a legal claim or not. They also can be very frightened when they receive these letters. When I talked to legal aid clinics about this, they indicated that in many cases, or at least some cases, when individuals receive these letters in the mail, they can't distinguish this as being something different than a criminal proceeding, and are worried if they don't pay this money, they may have the police coming to their door and things like that. And so people end up essentially paying this because they get a letter from a lawyer, they don't know that the claim may not be essentially valid, and they pay the money. And so the concern is that lawyers aren't really acting in this capacity to help people pursue legitimate legal claims, but rather they're kind of renting their letterhead out to take advantage of people. That's the concern. And again, they're essentially, they're form letters. The dozens and dozens of letters that I looked at all had the same content, just different addresses and names put in there. And if we look at some of the professional responsibility of lawyers, we know they have obligations to act with integrity. They have obligations to not assist a client in any dishonesty. They have obligations to act in good faith. And it's hard to really square what we're seeing in these letters with those obligations. So that's really the concern, that it's not really about practicing law. It's about taking advantage of people and advancing claims that don't really have much of a basis.
Yeah, so our next question is, what is the ethical role of a lawyer when deciding to or undertaking the drafting of an SCRL?
Yeah, good question. I think it ties a bit to some of what I was just saying, that if you're writing any type of demand letter, the lawyer does have the obligation to act in good faith, not encourage any dishonesty. And I think things like suggesting that litigation is a possibility, if it absolutely is not a possibility, is inconsistent with that, including unfounded demands for compensation is inconsistent with those obligations. Containing correspondence that has materially inaccurate or misleading statements of the law. Again, these letters aren't going to another lawyer, they're going to members of the general public. And when we're talking about these civil recovery letters in particular, in my research and in the article I wrote, I kind of went through every possible civil claim that could be made in the circumstance and the claims that were being asserted, and just couldn't see how these claims would be successful in court. And so for me, seeing that there's really no valid claims here, it's hard to think of any foundation for these letters. Like, what could be a good letter? If there's no possibility of a civil claim, then it's a real question as to whether or not these letters should exist.
So even as a follow-up to that question, how might lawyers be able to balance these obligations that they owe to society and to with the demands of their clients?
Yeah. I mean, when I think about these ethical issues that come up in practice, and again, as you noted in the introduction, I have a practice experience. I've worked at legal aid clinics and with the government. So I know, you know, we have to always understand what's happening on the ground in addition to the rules as written. But if we go back to first principles, we know, and you've probably heard as law students and the general public's aware, that lawyers really have this duty of loyalty to their clients, this duty of zealous advocacy, this duty to really fight for their clients. But any understanding by anybody always notes that this isn't unrestrained. So it's zealous advocacy within the bounds of the law. There's rules about what lawyers can or cannot do. They can't assist, for example, their client in committing a criminal offense. They can't lie to the court. So it is an obligation to advance your client's legal interests, but at the same time, it has to be respecting the bounds of the law. And the role of the lawyer really is to help a client assert or defend their legal rights, not just do whatever the client wants or get a result that's good for the client. And here, I think, as I indicated previously, these letters don't seem to be really about genuinely advancing legitimate legal rights. So I don't actually see it as being a balance. I think it's just not consistent with even resolute advocacy on behalf of the client, because it's not about pursuing their legal rights. It's simply, you know, some other people have used the word bullying people, and I think I can understand when they've used that word. And so, you know, I don't think it's necessarily, are we enforcing the public interest to the detriment of clients? I think we have to understand about, you know, what is a lawyer's proper role in representing clients? It's about advancing legitimate legal interests, not just doing what the client wants.
Mm-hmm. And even as a follow-up to that question, because honestly, you know, I'm still in my first year, and that's kind of what I felt too while reading it. It does seem a lot like bullying. And we all kind of understand the role of lawyers within society is they have to maintain a degree of trustworthiness and integrity for the legal system to really work. So would you even possibly think about the idea that, you know, the concept and impact that SCRLs currently have can hinder this perception of lawyer and undermine the actual value of our legal system?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. When you see people talking to the media, because there's been various media stories about these letters, or people in various chat rooms, people who've received these letters, you do see them being really frustrated with the lawyers that send them and not having those lawyers, you know, in good regard. So I think it does make a big impact. It makes the lawyer kind of seem like a hired gun for the clients, kind of just doing the client's bidding rather than someone who is respecting the administration of justice. So I do worry, and again, it's not many lawyers sending these letters. There's a subset of lawyers, but as we see in other matters, you know, sometimes it's that small group of lawyers that do things unethically or that raise concerns that can really damage the reputation of the profession.
Could you discuss briefly why SCRLs are misleading and have no legal basis?
Sure. Yeah. And again, here I'm talking about kind of the dozens and dozens I had a chance to review several years ago, which had very similar content. I don't want to speak for any possible letter that could be out there. But the ones that I looked at and the ones that legal clinics were saying that they were getting regularly, there's a variety of different issues about types of legal claims they advance. In the paper I wrote, I kind of have, I don't know if it's 20 pages describing it all in detail, so I won't go into that for your listeners here. But two of the main problems was that they often, when they're sent to parents, advance claims that are rooted in parental vicarious liability. And that essentially means the idea of vicarious liability. Well, this is your child who did something, so you're automatically responsible for that, essentially. And we have case law, even in the shoplifting context, that says that parents aren't vicariously responsible for the torts committed by their children. So having that case law is pretty clear, and it's been clear for a while. It's hard to find a good faith basis for then having a letter that asserts that parents need to pay up because it was their child that was alleged to have done that. The other issue is that, I think as I mentioned before, when these letters claim hundreds of dollars, it's not because they're claiming the value of the good alleged to be taken. Let's say it's a tube of chapstick, that's already been recovered. But these letters contain kind of this uniform amount of several hundred dollars that they're claiming. And they give a rationale that it's to offset essentially general security costs, just this kind of a prorated amount of that. And as I indicated in the paper, there's also case law that says that's simply not kind of a recoverable area of damages. Let's say you're a facility that puts a fence up to prevent trespassers from getting in. You can't then, if someone trespasses on your property, causes no damage, claim against them the cost for putting up that fence. That's not generally, and I haven't seen any case law that recognizes that as a category of compensation. So that's some ways in which, you know, these letters are making claims, and it's really hard to connect those claims to any type of viable legal action.
Yeah, thank you very much. And as a follow-up question to that, as someone who has no legal experience or a teenager that has been served as CRL, is it simply best for recipients to just ignore them until they have until they receive legal counsel?
I often, after I've kind of started to write in this area, I wrote a paper and a few blogs, I sometimes get letters from very concerned people that have received these letters and ask me what to do. And the answer I give to them is the answer I'll have to give to you, that, you know, I'm not in a position to kind of give legal advice to anybody, and I'm not currently actively licensed to give legal advice, so I steer away from kind of giving specific directions. One thing to note is there are some organizations that are positioned to offer guidance. So in Ontario, there's Justice for Children and Youth, and they have some guidance on their website. I think that you can also call them potentially to get guidance on certain matters. So I direct people there as one resource. But yeah, that's probably as far as I can go, because I can't be in a position of giving people legal advice, particularly when I don't see the contents of the exact letter they've gotten, and it could be a bit different than the things I'm talking about and things like that.
Of course, that does make a lot of sense. But as another sort of follow-up question, given that us three have only been observing it from almost a scholarly standpoint, what's your best estimate as to why clients submit SCRLs when they know that there's no legal basis behind them? Is it really a profitable practice? Your paper hints at what it's like in the States. Perhaps you could speak to that and what it's like in Canada.
Yeah. We can see information in the United States about this practice where you have kind of some firms sending out tens of thousands of these letters on an annual basis. It's one thing I noticed, again, it's essentially the ones I've seen are essentially form letters. So you can see how it'd be fairly cheap to send out. It's essentially a mail merge program and then the postage. And then of course, whatever fee arrangement that the retailer has with the lawyer. But the reality is, you know, when people get these letters, we do have some indication that a substantial number pay, again, out of fear or ignorance, some combination of the two. And here I should, you know, mention, which I haven't before, is one reason these letters are so powerful, of course, is because they come from a lawyer. It's not just anybody sending you a letter demanding anything. So again, the fact that it's on a lawyer's letterhead, I think, generates that motivation for people to pay. When I was researching this a few years ago, I tried to get stats, and it's not like retailers publish all their information on this in some sort of database or website. But what I did find in various reports is that one retailer in Canada reported that over 40% of people pay. So if you can think about thousands and thousands of these letters going out, hundreds of dollars, you know, 40% leading to payment, that's quite a lot of money. And one other indication is there was two major Canadian retailers that talked about how much money these letters brought in over a three-year period, and they said it was $1 million. So talking about significant amounts of money, and I think you know, certainly for the people who are paying this hundreds of dollars, for a lot of people that are paying it, it's a very significant amount of money to them.
That's kind of outrageous when you think about it. One thing I was wondering while reading the paper and kind of just dawned on me now, even just hearing that amount, how do they arrive at that number that they put on the letter? You know, I've noticed it's often like in the $300 range. Is it just a random number they pulled out of the aether? Or did they just, like, where does that 300 come from?
That's a really good question. One thing when I was researching this that I found out is that in the United States, in some states, there's a statutory right, a law that says retailers can send these sorts of letters. And in that law, they often state the amount, and that amount may be similar to what Canadian retailers are claiming. I assume they put an amount where they think they can make money, but it's not so much that no one can afford to pay, but I can't necessarily get into their minds about that. But we know it's certainly never connected to the value of the goods stolen. It's generally, from the things I've seen, considerably more. So it's a pack of gum and then a claim for paying up $400 or something like that.
Yeah, thank you very much for that. So I think you touched on this a little bit also before, but are parents vicariously liable or responsible for a child that is stolen from a store?
Yeah, good question. And again, a lot of these letters are directed to parents, and perhaps the idea that they're the ones with the funds to be able to pay. So in the paper, I go through a variety of ways that parents may be alleged to be responsible. So there's first that issue of vicarious responsibility. And there's clear case law that parents aren't vicariously responsible for the torts of their children. But we can also look to negligence. And it is possible for a parent to be liable in negligence for failing to reasonably supervise their child. And I go through the case law on this cause of action in the paper and explain how it's extremely unlikely to succeed. This just isn't the type of circumstance in which a parent is going to be held legally liable for failing to supervise their children. You'd have to have very unusual circumstances, probably, like you have kind of a very, very young child attending a store on their own, or you have, you know, a child who is repeatedly shoplifting and the parents aren't supervising them, something like that, maybe. But there's no indication that these letters are only sent in those circumstances. And then also in Ontario, we have statutory legislation, the Parental Responsibility Act, which again talks about reasonable supervision. And for the same reasons, it's unlikely to see a claim being made out. And on issues of negligence, of course, you also have to be able to prove damages to make out a claim. And here again, once the good is returned, if the person's in a possession of a good, it's really hard to know what kind of damages could be claimed if a retailers aren't able to kind of make that pro rata claim on security costs. So again, I kind of go through that in detail in the paper, but that's essentially in a nutshell why there doesn't seem to be in general a viable claim here involving parents.
Throughout this conversation thus far, we've kind of hinted at how the practice is viewed as, or acknowledged even as, unethical by many lawyers. So regarding the lawyers who do kind of violate these ethics by sending out SCRLs, is there a way that they're disciplined at all? Or is it just, you know, we kind of let them free range it, or what right. happened?
So I get, yeah, so talking about discipline, that would be the provincial and territorial law societies. And I'm not aware of any case in which a law society has publicly disciplined a lawyer for sending out these letters. I understand that it's likely that some law societies actually have more privately reached out to lawyers and asked them to change some of the contents of their letters. Perhaps that may have happened. There's no way of knowing about that because that's the law society's kind of private correspondence with that lawyer. But the general practice still continues, of course. And yeah, I don't have any particular insight as to why the law societies haven't disciplined more lawyers or publicly come out. To the extent I've heard anything, it's often that they think they've said that the validity of any civil claim should be decided by a court. Here, of course, these claims never get to a court because the retailers don't actually sue people, so we don't actually have much precedence. But again, the law societies would be best positioned to talk about why they've taken what I characterize as a hands-off approach.
Thank you. So what are scenarios in which SCRLs could be beneficial to maintain within the legal scope?
Yeah, Yeah, good question, because you always want to think about how can we make this practice more ethical and more consistent with lawyers' obligations. Again, I think, you know, thinking about this, I kind of go back to this idea that it's really, really hard to think about any viable civil claims in this particular type of context. And so then it's very hard to think about how you could have a civil recovery letter that is consistent with a lawyer's obligation to advance claims of good faith. So I kind of would say it's not really a matter of reform necessarily, but maybe not doing this practice at all.
Do you almost differentiate SDRLs from demand letters, and how could you possibly speak to how they're completely different and why demand letters, for instance, are worth maintaining within the legal scope and the purpose they serve?
Sure. Yeah. And I would say, you know, SCRLs, the ones I've looked at, I characterize a very particular type of demand letter. And demand letters can play in general, play a very beneficial role. They can avoid going to court and having people pay those extra lawyer fees or go through the stress of that and resolve something very quickly. So by sending a demand letter, for example, the example I gave at the beginning of our discussion, let's say you have a tenant who needs repairs done to their apartment. Rather than having to take the landlord to the landlord and tenant tribunal, fill in all that paperwork, wait months and months potentially, if they can have a lawyer send a letter requesting those repairs be done, maybe the matter could be dealt with much more expeditiously, lower cost, lower stress for everybody. You know, I think that can be very beneficial. With civil recovery letters or any type of demand letter, I do think they potentially cross a line into being problematic. Again, if they contain statements of the law that are misleading, contain claims not being made in good faith. So I think, you know, those are guidance that all lawyers should follow with any type of demand letter. But certainly demand letters can be a very appropriate part of a lawyer's practice.
For sure. Even just regarding ethical nature of them and the legality of them, since they are legal, even though they might not seem ethical, do you think that passing new laws or legislation that make the practice of sending SDRLs illegal would be a mistake?
Yeah, and good question, because, you know, I can talk about all the concerns with these letters, but the real question becomes, what might we do about this? You know, I think if we talk about a piece of legislation or a law, you know, I do think the government needs to be, you know, extremely careful if it wants to criminalize or otherwise ban speech. And I don't think these letters fall kind of into the rare circumstances where that makes sense. And again, here we're talking about lawyers, so you'd also worry maybe about the government entrenching on the self-regulation of lawyers if they started regulating in this area. In terms of something like a law society introducing a new rule for lawyers, you know, I do think if the law societies are going to address this issue, the more productive way may be to provide guidance as to what an appropriate content of a civil recovery letter is, rather than trying to ban something and then it becomes kind of a potentially even a semantic discussion about what actually is a civil recovery letter. What if people start calling them a different name? It may be more productive and really getting to the heart of the matter if you talk about what is appropriate content for any type of demand letter, or maybe even in a specific context. And we have seen, you know, regulators in other jurisdictions speak to this matter in the UK and the United States. And I looked at some of those examples when researching this matter.
Yeah. So further to that question, we were wondering what solutions would you believe can be implemented to curb the exploitation of SCRLs?
Yeah. I mean, one step obviously is public education. You know, the more the public understands the nature of these letters, the better. You know, ultimately, I think that's probably a limited response. Even with really robust public education messaging, I'm not sure you'll reach everybody who's receiving these types of letters. And I have, you know, in the past, I'll say it again, I do think it's incumbent on law societies to consider disciplining lawyers who send letters without a good faith basis. And again, it's always going to depend on exactly what civil recovery letter we're talking about. So it's always going to be very context specific. At the very least, publish practice guidance about what's appropriate to include in a demand letter. You know, so reminding lawyers about their obligations about acting in good faith, not assisting a client in dishonesty, things like that. Maybe even be more specific, saying if you're going to write a letter like this, you shouldn't suggest that litigation will occur if payment isn't made, if you know that there really is little or no chance that you're actually going to commence litigation. Not including in the letter, for example, there's a reasonable claim against parents. Not including in these letters that there's a claim for compensation for a prorated amount of your overall security costs. If the law clearly says that these things are recoverable, then maybe there's no place in the letters for these types of claims. And perhaps the Law Society should be specifically telling lawyers this.
So moving on even from the outside looking in, if we take a more internal look, what do you think some alternatives to SDRLs that store owners can take against shoplifters rather than sending out SDRLs would be?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to recognize that shoplifting is a problem that retailers face, and it comes at a cost to them. You know, I'm a lawyer who works in the area of legal ethics. That's really my wheelhouse. And I think I'll probably leave it to the corporations who are sending these letters to assess, you know, what's appropriate security policy, you know, from their perspective. I'll note as an aside, you know, retailers that are sending these letters are very sophisticated national corporations generally, with lots of resources, I think, to kind of think about what might be appropriate. You know, from my perspective, I'm really focused on worrying about the damage to public confidence in the legal profession, the damage to vulnerable members of the public when lawyers send letters, you know, based on my research that are materially misleading and often received by people in vulnerable positions. So curbing that practice is really my concern. I'll leave it to the big companies to figure out the shoplifting problem. You know, recognizing that, you know, this is a real problem for them and they need to look for solutions.
Fair enough. Professor Salazin, thank you so much for taking the time for joining us today on this discussion.
Thank you.
We're really lucky to have you here today and just learn everything that we did. To just reflect on a final point, the ability of large retailers to take advantage of young people with little experience dealing with the law is increasing due to these access to justice barriers, really. And this is why we decided to do our podcast on this topic. So we just really want to thank you again. And if you have any closing thoughts, you know, please.
Yeah, just thank you for taking on this topic and showing an interest in it. And I encourage people to look at sources of legal information from Justice for Children and Youth, other websites by nonprofits, and become more informed. Hopefully we can see maybe less of this practice as we go forward.
Absolutely. All right. Well,
thank you very much.
Thanks for your time.
Professor Salazin, thank you so much for taking the time to join us for this discussion on shoplifting civil recovery letters. We're very lucky to have the opportunity to learn from you today. I think as we end, I'd like to reflect on a final point. The ability of large retailers to take advantage of young people or people with little experience dealing with the law is increasing due to the increased access to justice barriers. This is why we have decided to do our podcast on shoplifting civil recovery letters, so that young people and those inexperienced with the law can understand their legal situation better and seek legal representation. Before we end the show, we once again like to say this podcast does not contain legal advice and is only a general discussion of certain legal issues. If you require legal advice, please consult a lawyer. We're your hosts, Kevin and Chris. If you like this interview, you can find more on the Queen's Pro Bono Radio website at probonoradio.com. Thank you all, and stay safe out there.
Welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. I'm your host, Tony Yin. Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics that aims to make legal discussions more accessible to you. We strive to stimulate interest and provide information while always being entertaining. This week's show is on adverse possession. Before the interview, we'd like to emphasize that this interview only contains general legal information. None of the discussion should be treated as legal advice. If you have any questions regarding property rights or adverse possession, please seek assistance from a legal professional. When discussing property rights, the metaphor of the bundle of rights is often brought up to explain the complexities of property ownership. The bundle of rights can be imagined as a bundle of sticks, where each stick represents an individual right. The bundle can be separated and reassembled. At any given time, a property owner possesses a set of sticks or rights in relation to the property. Under the bundle of rights metaphor, ownership of land is a much more complex composition than simply acquiring all the rights to a land. A single person can possess several rights in relation to a piece of property, and multiple people can also have rights and not necessarily identical rights to the same piece of property. The bundle of rights of property can be divided through, for example, a real estate investment trust to allow commercial investment into that real property. One concept that is intriguing under the bundle of rights theory is squatting. Squatting represents a non-economic way for people to transfer parts of the bundle of rights. Depending on the applicable laws, a squatter can acquire property rights by simply occupying vacant land for an extended period of time. However, squatters face great instability due to a lack of title and government efforts to remove these informal settlements. Squatting can result in adverse possession. In the common law, which is a legal system of judge-made law used here in Canada, adverse possession is the process by which title to a real property is acquired without compensation. This is done by continuous possession or occupation of the property without necessarily the permission of the property's legal owner. I'm joining us now in the studios to discuss the concept of property and adverse possession as Professor Larissa Katz. She currently holds a Canadian research chair in the private law theory. Prior to joining the Faculty of Law at the University of Toronto in 2013, Professor Katz clerked at the Supreme Court of Canada, worked in litigation at Sullivan and Cromwell, and taught at Queen's University Faculty of Law. And Professor Katz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tony. I'm delighted to talk to you about property.
Yes. So, to start off, I think it's safe to say that adverse possession, especially for people not in the legal profession, is a concept that could be difficult to grasp. You talk about this topic in great length in your article, The Moral Paradox of Adverse Possession. Do you mind just going a little bit more in depth and explain to the listeners how adverse possession works in the Canadian common law system? Are there any Canadian or Ontario laws that concern adverse possession?
Yeah, so adverse possession is a feature of common law systems of property around the world where we find the common law at work. So in England, in the UK, in the US, in Canada, and elsewhere. And adverse possession is a mechanism through which a squatter, someone who has been possessing land for a period of time, is able to acquire better title to that land than the paper title holder, the original owner. So adverse possession is a feature, as I said, of common law systems of property. And it is a feature that has come under a lot of criticism and scrutiny by judges as well as by, just members of the public. There's a sense that there's something sort of unjust about the operation of a law. And adverse possession really operates through the statute of limitations that prevents the original owner from ejecting the squatter after the statutory period of time, usually 10 years, has passed. There's a sense that there's something unjust about that, that if somebody owns land, they should not lose their property rights just in virtue of someone else's having wrongfully taken possession of the land. And so there's a sense that adverse possession requires some extra justification, some additional explanation, or that its application should be limited to cases where its social value is clearer, So I'm thinking here of cases of boundary disputes between neighbors where there might be, you know, one neighbor who has built a garden shed, you know, 5 centimeters over the property line, and now perhaps would suffer, you know, a disproportionate loss if she were required to dismantle the garden shed in order to, you know, ensure that her uses of her land are only in, within the boundaries of her own property rights. So that would be an example where adverse possession seems to do some good. It seems to resolve at a very low cost conflict between neighbors. And, you know, people generally will stomach the use of adverse possession in contexts like that. Where adverse possession, you know, has a bad rap is where we see squatters taking possession of larger tracts of land, not under any illusion about their rights, where they know full well someone else owns the land, and yet they are deliberately setting out to take it over anyway. These are the cases of so-called bad faith adverse possession, where you have an adverse possessor whose mindset is, in effect, hostile to the rights, the property rights of the true owner. And there we see judges have been reluctant to allow adverse possession to run its course. Now, we should bear in mind, to give you a little context, that adverse possession is a common law doctrine. That is to say that it's come out of the common law of property, the judge-made law of property that has been developed over centuries in, you know, common law countries like the UK and Canada. In many jurisdictions, and in Ontario, for example, in particular, we have statutes, for example, the Land Titles Act, that sharply restricts the applicability of adverse possession in order to prevent people from acquiring new property rights through adverse possession. This is something we can talk about later, but it's a kind of a response to the worries that I flagged that people have about adverse possession, that there's a sense that we want property rights to pass from one owner to the next in sanctioned ways through, for example, grant, through sale, through inheritance, but not through these, you know, sort of facts on the ground, you know, sort of hostile takeovers that we see as characteristic of bad faith adverse possession. So the Land Titles Act, which sharply restricts the availability of adverse possession to squatters, ensures or tries to ensure that, you know, the facts on the ground don't win the day. That is what's on the books, the law on the books that matters. Land Titles Acts give priority, of course, to the paper title holder, the person who has registered title in the land title system. So that's a kind of interesting development. We see that, you know, in many jurisdictions that have a common law system of property, we have this overlay of statute that tries to restrict this area of doctrine that I have argued in my own work, nonetheless, has a really important role to play, even in cases where there's bad faith squatters.
So from our discussion right now and from reading your article, you talked about some analogies. One analogy you talked about is comparing adverse possession to land fee, which you mentioned just right now. But another analogy that you brought up in your article, Moral Paradox of Adverse Possession, is that you actually compare it to a revolution, especially of a bloodless coup. Could you just maybe expand this a little bit? What is your reasoning behind this analogy?
Mm-hmm. So when I look at adverse possession, I see the intuitive appeal of thinking of squatters as land thieves, a person who is stealing from another person, the true owner. And the paradox that I think instantly strikes us is the standpoint that the law takes toward the squatter before she has met the statutory requirements of 10 years of adverse possession, and the standpoint of the law after the 10 years passes, which is that this squatter, who before was treated effectively as a thief, now emerges triumphant as the new owner of the land. And how to reconcile the very different standpoints, the before and the after standpoint that the law takes to the squatter who is taking over possession of someone else's land. And, you know, thinking about it a little bit more, I took the view that adverse possession, the way that it operates, reflects something very fundamental and basic about the nature of property. That at its very core, property, the ownership of land, which is, of course, what we're concerned with here, is a position of authority, the authority to set the agenda for land in a way that regulates the activities of others. And a position of authority backed by law is actually meant to do something for the way that we all relate. It's actually meant to serve the purpose of coordinating our activities, of in fact supplying a framework for the way that we interact with respect to land. So what happens generally, I ask myself, when someone who has authority, in principle, has the right to exercise authority, loses the capacity to exercise authority? So what happens if we now move to the public law context? What happens when someone with the right to rule loses the basic de facto capacity to rule, loses the capacity to issue the kind of authoritative pronouncements, for example, that we associate with law that actually regulates or coordinates the interactions of people within a bounded territory? So we have a lot of precedent for thinking about this in history. So then one example that I take up in my article concerns the so-called White Russians, who fled Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution and who took up, a kind of shadow government in London, England, with the support of the British. And, you know, everybody internationally recognized the right to rule of the White Russians. They recognized that the White Russians had the right to rule, you know, the territory that comprised Russia. But after a certain amount of time had passed, when the Bolshevik Revolution clearly had succeeded, at some point, the loss of de facto authority undermined the possibility of de jure authority by that White Russian shadow government in London. At some point, even though the international community recognized the right to rule and the initial wrongfulness of a revolution, when the dust settled, the very possibility of authority, of effective authority, as opposed to merely theoretical authority, requires also de facto authority, the actual exercise of the authority that a person claims to have the right to. So at some point, it makes no sense to say that the White Russians were making law for the Russian people. No, actually, the Bolsheviks were making law for the Russian people in Russia. And at some point, the same transformation happens in property law. After sufficient passage of time, 10 years is the period that we have sort of set for ourselves in our law, after 10 years has passed where the true owner has lost control of the position of ownership, has effectively been ousted from the office of ownership, at some point that person no longer has de facto authority. The agenda-setting authority is exercised, in fact, by the squatter.
Well, one thing you talked about there that kind of interests me is that one worry that could be brought up is that although we do now have an owner of property and they can be recognized as wielding that power, can we also have a reason to recognize the adverse possessor's claim to that authority then? How would you respond to that worry?
So that is a very legitimate worry, right? The idea that the claim to the authority of the adverse possessor is based on nothing more than the de facto taking up of possession. Now, adverse possession has always ruled out possession by force or fraud. So we have this sense that force or fraud cannot be a part of this bloodless coup, right, in a sense. That it is only just through the actual and effective exercise of agenda-setting authority by the squatter that that person comes to be recognized as the person who occupies the office of ownership at the end of the day. We come to recognize that the original owner has, in effect, abdicated the office, is no longer in office, and has been ousted in some sense, but not through force and not through fraud, right? But simply through a failure herself to exercise authority. Now remember, throughout that 10-year period, at any time, the true owner can go to court and get assistance in ejecting the squatter, can herself step up and start to assume the responsibilities of ownership by in fact exercising agenda-setting authority herself. So at any time within the 10-year period, it is open for her to simply fully in fact, occupy the office of ownership. She's not subject to force or fraud in the ouster. It's her failure to do that for 10 years that leaves, from the point of view of law, no other conclusion than, well, it seems that the office holder here is the squatter, just in virtue of the facts on the ground that we see. Now, the claim of right, so there's something kind of interesting in the law's reaction to our claims of right to property versus our claims of right to a person. So there's no way in which I'm going to forfeit my right to my person in the way that we see through adverse possession, the true owner forfeiting her right to the office of ownership. And my view is that that has to do with the very nature, the very different nature of the two rights involved. That when the, in the context of property, we're talking about a kind of office. That is to say, the warrant to make decisions about a matter of shared concern, what can be done with this land around here. Whereas when it comes to my person and my right to my person, that's a truer right, if you like. It's a right that nobody else can stand in the same way that I can. No one else can assume or take up my right to my person. So that there's no sense in which I can forfeit that right through non-use. So this again highlights the very different natures of these two different rights, the right to property on the one hand and the right to the person on the other. And if we start to think about ownership as a kind of office, we can understand why it is that the law looks to whether or not the office is being filled in backstopping and in supporting our claim of right to property rights. So there's a property right, and then there's a right to property rights. I look at the property right as an office, and the right to the office as the claim of title that we have, the claim of right that we have as owners. We can lose that, right? Where someone else has more effectively taken up the position. Now, again, it's a very low standard we hold owners to, even in the common law of property. Just maintain some de facto authority here, so that you can be said to actually occupy the office of ownership. Some. Doesn't have to be much. The owner doesn't have to do much to prove that she has retained ownership, right? And to disallow the squatter from establishing that the squatter has exclusive agenda-setting authority.
So linking this concept to another concept that you talked about right here and from another article that you wrote titled Exclusion and Exclusivity in Property Law, you talked about how when you focus on models of ownership, we should be focusing more on preservation of the owner's position as an exclusive agenda setter for their own thing, rather than focusing on the right of exclusion of all non-owners, for example, squatters, I guess. So how do you think the dynamic between these play together? It seems to me to be a very interesting concept. How do they interact, I guess?
Yeah, great. So right. So exclusion and exclusivity was an article I wrote in 2008. It was actually my first property article when I was a very new academic. And I had this intuition then that property couldn't be fully understood just in terms of the right to exclude along the boundaries of the thing, but had to be understood as the authority, the exclusive authority, to set the agenda within the boundaries of the thing. This view of property, I thought, helped to explain a number of doctrinal puzzles. It also, in my view, helped to explain why adverse possession worked the way that it did. That adverse possession really was trying to flesh out who was effectively the agenda setter with respect to this parcel of land. And so one way in which adverse possession can be understood to really be tracking the effectiveness of agenda setting authority is through the inconsistent use test that we find in some jurisdictions. This is a test that was developed in Canada by Bertha Wilson, Justice Bertha Wilson, when she was on the Court of Appeal. It's a controversial test, I'm going to add right away, so not everyone thinks that it's the right way to understand adverse possession. But this idea of inconsistent use, the test of inconsistent use, is aimed at understanding whether anything that the squatter is doing, whether anything that that squatter is doing as a possessor, is actually inconsistent with the agenda the owner, the paper title holder, the original owner, has set for that land. So if the owner, the original owner, has set an agenda that is in no way in conflict with what the possessor is doing, then the possessor, the adverse possessor, isn't actually really adverse. They're not challenging the authority of the original owner in any meaningful way. By contrast, where the squatter can show that her activities that constitute her possession of that land are inconsistent with the original owner's plans for the land, she can establish that, in fact, she has taken over the agenda-setting function rather than simply slotting in and acting in harmony with the original owner's agenda. So, in a way, this understanding of ownership as exclusive agenda-setting authority allows us to identify the kinds of challenges that are the most fundamental to the very position of ownership itself. The challenges that are the most fundamental are not the boundary crossings that happen all the time, actually, without in any way undermining ownership. The kind of challenge that undermines ownership is a rival agenda setter who sets an agenda that is inconsistent with the original owner's agenda for that very same piece of land.
To hear the remainder of this episode, please visit probonoradio.com. Immigration is at the heart of Canadian culture and industry. That's why Queen's University is proud to offer the Graduate Diploma in Immigration and Citizenship Law, an immersive, full-time, year-long online program that is training the next generation of immigration professionals. Learn from experts in an engaging online learning environment. Build critical skills and real-world competencies that will make you practice-ready for an exciting career. Apply now. Visit immigrationdiploma.ca for more information.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a song from local metal band Exogen's debut EP entitled Game of Puppets, released on all streaming platforms on Friday, January 3rd. Featuring four heavy genre blending tracks, the EP was created by Ben Snyder, Joe Shell, Nathan Graham, and Isaac Heathcock, and produced by Terry Benn at Switzerville Sound Retreat. We've been fortunate to have amazing fans and friends supporting us, says the band, and they hope to keep the metal scene growing in Kingston. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Game of Puppets on your favorite platforms and enjoy today's selection from this new EP called Fleeting Moments, here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.